a different kind of genocide happening through imprisonment, through forced sterilization behind bars, I knew that I wanted to get involved. And initially, it was by becoming a volunteer with Justice Now, and later becoming a volunteer legal advocate working with over 150 people who were incarcerated in California's women's prisons. And as you see in the film, and as you're talking about, that history of eugenics in the United States is not something that we talk about a lot. When we hear the word eugenics, we think of Nazi Germany, we think of the Holocaust, but actually what we don't talk about is the founding of the eugenics movement in the United States, and actually how Nazi Germany came to California to learn from our eugenics leaders to take our policies and practices back.
We're going to leave it there, but do part two and have a continued conversation with you. I do want to give Kelly the last word. You have 10 seconds. What would justice look like for you?
So right now we have a petition that's on www.bellyofthebeastfilm.org. .com. And what we're trying to do is seek compensation in order to all the survivors to not only be identified, but to be notified, because there's a lot of hidden victims. And so we're looking for compensation for not only the survivors, but for the ones that are unknown as well.
Kelly Dillon, thanks so much for being with us as well. Thank you to Erica Cohen, director of Belly of the Beast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Home for Everyone, a virtual fundraiser for immigrant and refugees' rights. On Friday, October 2nd, from 5 to 6 p.m., streaming online. The fundraiser will include an overview of the issues facing the asylum process, updates from Innovation Law Lab on their mini projects to dismantle the deportation regime, and a musical performance. Again, that's Home for Everyone, a virtual fundraiser for immigrant and refugee rights, on Friday, October 2nd from 5 to 6 p.m. streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Protests in Portland continued last night after restarting last week following a brief break due to wildfires and unhealthy air quality. The U.S. death toll from COVID-19 tops 200,000. Following the passing of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Republicans are moving quickly to fill her seat before the November elections. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 22nd, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Protests against police brutality and racial injustice continued Monday night in Portland, with demonstrators gathering outside the Penumbra Kelly building. Independent reporters on scene estimated the group of demonstrators to be about 100 people. Protesters first gathered at Laurelhurst Park and marched about a half mile to the Penumbra Kelly building. Many in the group specifically called for the total abolition of police and prisons. The group arrived at the Kelly building, located on East Burnside near 47th Avenue, just before 9:30 p.m. Police were already waiting in front of the building. The site has previously been the scene of clashes between demonstrators and police. PPB officers told demonstrators not to go on the property and threatened arrest and the use of munitions if the order was not followed. By 1 a.m., the crowd of protesters had dispersed without any arrests or use of munitions by police. Protests in Portland resumed last week after a brief break due to wildfires and unhealthy air quality across the state. Also on Monday, the U.S. Department of Justice identified Portland, along with Seattle and New York City, as so-called anarchist jurisdictions. Many have called the move a political attack and are criticizing Donald Trump's threat to revoke federal funding for cities during a global pandemic. According to new reporting in The Nation, two former intelligence officers have confirmed the use of cell phone interception technology against protesters by multiple agencies working with the Department of Homeland Security. Fears of government surveillance spread through Portland this summer as unidentified government agents descended on the city as part of DHS's Operation Diligent Valor. The goal of the operation was to protect federal buildings and statues from destruction by protesters. It included agents from Border Patrol, Federal Protective Services, and the U.S. Marshals. The situation received national attention in July when viral video footage showed unidentified officers detaining protesters in unmarked vans. In late July, The Washington Post reported that the DHS Office of Intelligence and Analysis collected information on journalists covering the protests. Members of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees called for full transparency of all data collection on both protesters and journalists. DHS has not responded to these calls, though Acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, has asked for an immediate end to investigations involving journalists. New information on cell phone surveillance of protesters was released yesterday by The Nation. According to two unnamed sources, a task force of DHS and Justice Department officials used a sophisticated cell phone cloning operation to collect private communications in Portland. The technology used clones the signals of nearby cell phones and intercepts all communications these devices receive. Experts on government secrecy and surveillance say this type of information gathering is not helpful for stopping immediate looting or damage to buildings. In August, the U.S. Marshals Service confirmed it had used a small plane to conduct aerial surveillance of the Portland area, but did not interfere with cell phones. Two former DHS officials speaking with The Nation agreed that the surveillance of cell phones was most likely conducted by agents from multiple agencies on the ground, including the Drug Enforcement Administration. Stephen Aftergood, head of the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy, told The Nation, quote, "The general concern is that DHS treated mass public protests, not just violent individuals, as suspicious and targets of investigation, or worse." The full extent of the surveillance operation is still unknown. The ACLU called for an investigation into this operation on Twitter, citing the unwarranted tapping of protesters' phones as, quote, "an outrageous violation of their constitutional rights." The city of Louisville, Kentucky, is under emergency order awaiting the state attorney general's investigation results in Breonna Taylor's murder. For more, we go to KBOO's Al Kahn.
As an announcement by Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron regarding a decision by a grand jury in Louisville, Kentucky, which was convened to investigate the details of the killing of Breonna Taylor looms, the mayor has declared a state of emergency. Mayor Greg Fisher issued a press release today stating he has signed two executive orders, which will allow him to exercise emergency powers in anticipation of civil unrest. According to the statement, the first order will allow Fisher to hire or contract additional law enforcement and other services while also allowing the implementation of curfews and any other restriction that he sees fit. The second order cuts off access to 5 downtown parking garages and prohibits street parking in an approximately 25-block perimeter in the downtown area. Police have already installed barricades around this area to keep any vehicles from entering. Even though both Fisher and Louisville's interim chief of police, Robert Schroeder, have said they don't know when to expect a decision from the grand jury, the state of emergency has been put in place to prepare for any eventuality when it does come. Schroeder, speaking to the press this morning, says he hopes to look back on the restrictive moves as an overreaction, yet stressed that the actions were deemed necessary to protect the public. Schroeder also apologized to any who feel the police department has put the downtown area in a lockdown, saying that this is not the intent, while defending the department's action as necessary. Meanwhile, Cameron has said on numerous occasions there is no set timeline for the investigation or when he will announce the decision, which makes the length of the state of emergency indefinite. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
On Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 308 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the total number of cases in the state up to 31,313. Oregon health officials also reported 3 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 532 people. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases on Tuesday, with 60, followed by Washington County with 42 and Marion County with 38 cases. As of Tuesday afternoon, more than 6.9 million people in the U.S. have been infected with COVID-19. The U.S. death toll from the coronavirus topped 200,000 on Tuesday. The bleak milestone is the highest confirmed death toll from the virus in the world. Over the past week, there have been an average of about 41,800 cases per day, an increase of 7% from the average 2 weeks earlier. According to the CDC, the majority of COVID-19 deaths during the early months of the pandemic occurred in communities with lower incomes and denser populations of people of color. Miami-Dade County in Florida, the fourth largest school district in the U.S., will reopen classrooms to students for in-person learning next month. Students would attend classes 5 days a week, but families who prefer virtual learning will be able to stick with that option. About half of the district's families chose remote learning when selecting an option this summer. The reopening would make the county the largest district in the country to have students in classrooms full-time. New York City, the nation's largest district, already began in-person instruction on Monday, but with students only attending part-time. Students in Los Angeles and Chicago, the second and third largest systems, are attending classes remotely. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 31.4 million people in nearly every country. At least 966,500 people have died across the world. Many elementary school teachers across the country were not able to provide direct instruction in academic skills more than once per week during school closures, with more than 20% reporting never providing direct instruction in academic skills. Eric Galatis has more on the story with the Public News Service.
As kids and parents navigate the uncertain territory of being back in school during a pandemic, a new University of Nebraska-Lincoln study shows that elementary teachers nationwide believe just 3 out of 5 of their students were prepared to advance to the next grade level after school shut down during the health emergency. Report co-author Mark Goodrich says just a third of teachers were able to hold daily virtual meetings in real time with students, and most had to ask kids to practice math and reading skills on their own.
But that's not a substitute for direct instruction, especially for the students who are struggling to acquire reading or math skills. Without that sort of face-to-face interaction, a lot of students might continue to fall behind.
School closures were in sync with CDC guidelines for kids to avoid contracting and spreading COVID-19 by staying at least 6 feet apart, not possible in most classrooms. But closures also exposed a profound digital divide across the country, with many kids unable to attend class because they didn't have internet access or computers. As many as 11 million students in grades K through 5 received no instruction at all for up to 22 weeks of the school year. Despite tremendous efforts by schools and teachers to provide instructional opportunities for students, Goodrich says the research suggests that remote learning restricts access to high-quality education, especially for the most vulnerable students. He notes that even before the pandemic, students from wealthier families had higher academic achievement than disadvantaged students, and the health crisis amplified those disparities.
The lack of regular internet access and the lack of opportunities to engage in live instruction that we saw that were disproportionately affecting students from low-income backgrounds more might lead to achievement gaps widening.
Researchers found that nearly 7 in 10 teachers don't believe remote instruction was effective or are unsure about its effectiveness. Goodrich says his team plans to do multiple follow-up surveys throughout the school year to continue to track how COVID-19 is impacting education. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
The unemployment rate in the Portland metro area dropped to 8.3% in August. On Tuesday, the Oregon Employment Department said that about 110,000 area residents were unemployed, which is more than twice the number of unemployed people in August of last year. The Portland area's August unemployment rate dropped 2.7% from July, The metro area gained 7,500 jobs in August. The largest job gain in the month of August was in the construction sector, followed by the government sector as many employees at public schools returned to work. In addition, all of Oregon's 36 counties saw decreases in unemployment rates in August. Oregon's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate was 7.7% last month, compared to 8.4% unemployment nationally. You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, presenting Women Rising Radio with Jennifer Cohn and Andrea Miller, two election protection activists, talking about threats to the U.S. electoral process. Then at 6, it's Preference. And at 7, it's Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 63 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 69 degrees. Today in history, in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln issues a preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, which sets a date for the freedom of more than 3 million enslaved in the U.S. and recasts the Civil War as a fight against slavery. The quote of the day is from former President Barack Obama, who said, quote, "Change will not come if we wait for some other person or some other time. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the change that we seek." With the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Republicans are rushing to fill her seat before the November election. For more, we go to KBOO's Al Kahn.
Senator Mitt Romney of Utah has announced that he is in favor of a Senate vote to confirm Donald Trump's pick for the Supreme Court to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg before the November 3rd election. This all but guarantees that the vote will take place in that time frame, following on the heels of Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander's announcement 2 days ago. Alexander was seen as one of the most likely senators to join Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski and Maine's Susan Collins in opposition to the vote. The Senate pushing for the vote so close to the election is in direct conflict of the refusal to vote on confirming President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland in 2016, when Republicans, led by Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, argued that the nomination should be made by an incoming president as it would reflect the will of the people. Republicans now hold a 53-47 majority in the Senate, and it would take four GOP senators to oppose the vote, as Mike Pence could break a 50-50 tie in favor of Trump. Trump has said he will announce his pick to fill Ginsburg's seat on Saturday. On top of the list being considered by Trump is appellate court judge Amy Coney Barrett, who is known for her anti-abortion stance and strong religious beliefs. She was also in the running for the seat, which opened after the passing of Justice Anton Scalia, but was passed over in favor of Brett Kavanaugh. Also on the short list is Judge Barbara Lagoa, who has served on Florida's Supreme Court and is of Cuban descent. A Lagoa nomination before the election would be a strong influence to Florida's Latino population. One thing that is very clear, whoever Trump nominates, there will be a vote for confirmation before the presidential inauguration in January. For KBOO News, I'm Al Kahn.
Under a Nevada law upheld by a federal judge on Monday, all active state voters would receive a mail-in ballot for the November 3rd election due to the nation's health emergency. Roz Brown has more on the story with the Public News Service.
A day ahead of National Voter Registration Day, a federal judge ruled Nevada can move forward with its new vote-by-mail law. On Monday, a lawsuit filed by President Donald Trump's re-election campaign over Nevada's mail-in voting measure was dismissed. That means active voters would receive a mail-in ballot regardless of whether they request one. Chris Davin leads Equality Nevada in Henderson, an advocacy group for civil rights, particularly the LGBTQ community. He says the group encourages voters to choose pro-equality candidates, whether it's the White House, State House, or City Council.
We're seeing a very high amount of people that are coming in that are young. A lot of the acts and the millennials. They want to make sure that their voice is heard because they need change.
Trump blasted the state's new mail-in voting law at a re-election rally in Henderson earlier this month, saying it would be fraudulent. Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak responded to the judge's ruling Monday, saying the state law would expand options for Nevadans and provide for safe, fair, and accessible elections during the pandemic. Roughly one-third of all Nevada voters have said they plan to vote by mail. Davin does not believe potential fraud allegations are valid.
People get their tax returns, people get their stimulus checks, they get their driver's license. Everything comes by mail. What is the concern of the election ballot coming by mail?
Nevadans who want to register to vote online must do so by October 29th, but the deadline for registering by mail is much earlier, October 6th, which is the same deadline for registering to vote in person. Nevada's early voting period begins Saturday, October 17th, and continues through October 30th, but dates and hours may vary based on the city where you live. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
It's National Voter Registration Day. Plus, the Supreme Court and abortion are back center stage in the election spotlight. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
We want to make sure that you're registered. And if you're already registered, we want to make sure you check your registration. And then we want to make sure you have a plan for voting.
It's National Voter Registration Day today, and registration deadlines are already looming in some states. James Perry with the Winston-Salem Urban League in North Carolina wants to reverse the decline in voter registrations and turnout in the last presidential election. The Supreme Court is now center stage in the election spotlight after the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She served on the court for 27 years and died on Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, one of the holiest days in Judaism. A quick nomination and Senate vote for her replacement could hurt vulnerable GOP senators. In 2016, the Senate refused to consider President Obama's nomination because it was an election year. Observers say it's a calculated risk. Democrats could gain control of the Senate. But Yale law professor Samuel Moyne says a 6-3 majority could lock in conservative control of the court for a generation.
Does McConnell care about that more than his own Senate control?
In a new Politico Morning Consult poll, half the voters say the winner of the presidential election should make the nomination. 37% say Trump and McConnell should push it through.
There's no constitutional reason McConnell can't push it through if he has the votes. So all the talk about like norms and history and such, it's just all partisan angling.
President Trump said yesterday he'll wait until the end of the week to announce his nomination to respect Ginsburg's funeral services, though he also suggested that Ginsburg's last words dictated to her granddaughter were false. Overturning legal abortion is a long-term strategy of a faction of the Republican Party. With the possibility of another socially conservative justice, reproductive rights organizers are doubling down on their efforts to, in their words, protect Ginsburg's legacy.
I don't think you can overstate what the loss of Justice Ginsburg means to women, to the reproductive rights movement, and to our nation.
In Colorado, Stephanie Clark is campaigning against Proposition 115, a ballot measure to ban abortions after 22 weeks.
And the fact is, she was one of the strongest remaining defenders of safe and legal abortion on the Supreme Court. So if you thought the stakes couldn't get any higher in this election, they just did.
And yesterday, Attorney General William Barr echoed Trump's previous threats to withhold federal funding from Democratic-led cities, Portland, Seattle, and New York City, accusing them of permitting, quote, anarchy. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio thinks the administration's threats are part of a strategy to mobilize the Trump voter base.
He tries to convince a lot of people in this country that we all are the problem, and he will save his voters from all of us. There's just no president in history who's been this irresponsible and divisive, but it's the only trick he knows.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
The First Nation points to fishing rights in a lobster dispute, Native elders encourage community members to vote, and the Cherokee Nation proclaims Voter Registration Day. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A confrontation is heating up over lobster fishing in Nova Scotia. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Indigenous harvesters began setting their lobster traps a week ago which were then removed by non-Indigenous fishermen over the weekend.
The First Nation says its people have the right to fish outside of the regular season since it was granted to them by treaty. Their action to set traps before the season begins comes 21 years after a landmark decision by the Supreme Court of Canada. It confirmed that Mi'kmaq Donald Marshall had a treaty right to fish for eels when and where he wanted without a license. The decision also said several native bands in eastern Canada could hunt, fish, and gather to earn a moderate living. Just days after the Mi'kmaq placed their lobster traps, a flotilla of non-Indigenous fishing boats entered the waters and removed about 350 traps. There was a tense confrontation at a wharf in western Nova Scotia. Colin Spruill of the local Fishermen's Association says the gear was removed because the traps were set out of season.
This is not about race. This is not about treaty rights. It's about greed and corruption and no respect for a nursery ground.
But Mi'kmaq Chief Michael Sachs says his people are standing their ground.
Go home. Enjoy your vacation. Your season starts in a couple of weeks. And if they keep bugging us, we'll be there for the start of their season.
With neither side appearing ready to back down, the Minister of Fisheries has called for calm and has invited industry and Native leaders to meet with her as soon as possible. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Elders of the Gila River Indian community in Arizona are encouraging tribal members to register to vote and exercise their rights. Bonnie Lyons is involved in an elders group in the community and is working on get-out-the-vote efforts.
It is our voices that are being put down on that ballot. Whatever party you vote for, that is your voice. And what you're doing when you're voting is you're thinking of what's going to happen years from now. Whoever you get into power, that is your statement on how you want the future to be. Because you need to think about not just yourself, but the generations to come. You know, we're always taught that we need to look at the generations to come. We need to plan ahead. By doing that, by voting, you're exercising that right and just making sure that the community is looked after.
Joe Biaketti encouraged younger generations to listen to elders and remember their history, pointing to those who fought for rights.
Voting is power. We need to exercise that, use that, fight back, get our respect and the things that we need for our people. And the things that we must look at is our history.
The elders took part in a virtual Get Out the Vote and Census event over the weekend, which included tribal leaders, state officials, and members of Congress. The National Congress of American Indians is highlighting National Voter Registration Day, focusing on the Native vote. A live stream event Tuesday afternoon will discuss voter registration efforts in Indian country with tribal leaders and Native women in office. Other guests will be from key swing states where the Native vote has made a difference in local, state, and national races. Voting advocates are working to increase voting momentum as COVID-19 has hindered in-person voting events. And the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma proclaimed Cherokee Voter Registration Day. Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr.
2020 is an important election year at both the federal and local levels.
The proclamation was read during a live stream signing ceremony Tuesday morning. Since 2013, the tribe's Vote Project has registered more than 13,000 people. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Khan and Samantha Lau. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Roz Brown, Eric Galatis, and Antonia Gonzalez. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. News and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, arts, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Art Talk Bus Stop, featuring an interview with Rio Collier and Christian Osorio, founders of Roots and Beats Project. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We're currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Making Contact, presenting Women Rising Radio.
This week on Making Contact.
I think election fraud has always been a problem and a concern to various extents. And the main issue, whether you're talking about paper ballots or voting machines, is transparency. Transparency is really the number one thing. I think you have to really have the public involved from beginning to end.
We've got people that are really trying to cheat to win at all costs. Remember, we are talking about power. Power is never going to be given away by anybody. So it has to be taken.
In the United States, vote rigging and election fraud have become increasingly high tech and more difficult to expose. In this Women Rising radio program, we featured two election protection activists. Andrea Miller is an organizer and digital strategist fighting voter suppression. Jennifer Cohn is an attorney investigating the dangerous flaws in voting machines and technology. I'm your host, Sandina Robbins. I remember when, after the hotly disputed Bush versus Gore election in 2000, I volunteered to be a poll worker to see democracy in action for myself. At the end of a 12-hour day, we had to pack up our voting machines, count all the leftover ballots and supplies, and drive them to an unmarked trailer truck where they were loaded up and sent off into the dark of night. No one could tell me when or where these votes would be counted. Meanwhile, election results were already being announced on the radio based on early voting trends. It left me wondering, does every vote really count? For the next election in 2004, I was asked to be in charge of a precinct and sent to a training that primarily dealt with how to set up the voting machines so their legs wouldn't collapse. I was told to pick up our precinct's equipment before election day. That meant that I had the keys to the voting machines, ballots, a card encoder, all in my home for a week, with no security to prevent anyone from tampering with the system. On election night, we packed everything up, drove to a drop-off center, and once again I watched in amazement at how our votes were being boxed up just as the election results were being called. The question remains for me, does the U.S. really have free and fair elections?
Many of us don't know the first thing about how our votes get counted.
When you cast your ballot, how do you know that they're getting it right?
That they're getting it right?
Yeah.
Oh, well, isn't that their job to get it right?
Do you trust that your vote is being recorded as intended? What do you think?
I think so.
What are you basing that on?
How do you know that they got it right?
Know. Well, I'm sure they did.
Well, they what are you basing that
they
on?
They wouldn't be.
I don't know. They put it in the machine. I have to assume they're going to read it correctly.
A room full of hackers, all trying to hack into voting machines.
You can possibly make it accept a fake card or accept any card, so you could add your own votes.
These are supposed to be the latest machines. They're still used in elections, and they're running ancient software. I think that, like, if somebody wanted to, it would be pretty easy to fake an election.
Report from the Select Committee on Intelligence, United States Senate. Cybersecurity experts have studied a wide range of U.S. voting machines, including both DREs and optical scanners. And in every single case, they found severe vulnerabilities that would allow attackers to sabotage machines and to alter votes. That's why there is overwhelming consensus in the cybersecurity and election integrity research communities that our elections are at risk. One of the critical issues facing our democracy is the use of electronic voting machines. Election officials have tried to assure voters that the machines are accurate and safe from hacking. But an increasing number of digital security experts are saying no, they are not secure nor reliable. Attorney Jennifer Cohn has done extensive investigation into voter technology and is sounding the alarm.
I got drawn in by at least two things. The first was this chasm between what election officials were telling the public about the security of our elections, comparing that with what election security experts were saying about the security of our elections. Tom Hicks, who is on the Federal Election Assistance Commission, which certifies voting machines, was on the news telling the public that we didn't have to really worry about voting machines being hacked because they weren't connected to the internet. But even when voting machines themselves are not connected to the internet, they all receive programming from these centralized county or state computers. And in many cases, those do connect to the internet. So in reality, we're really just one or two steps away from having an internet hacker attack our system. When you're dealing with a black box voting machine, the public has no way of knowing what's happening inside of the machine. And the best way to describe transparency in this context is a translation from a German court ruling. I think it was in 2009. Their constitutional court outlawed touchscreen voting machines and said that the average person needs to be able to understand the mechanisms that are being used to count their votes. And if you can't do that, then it's unconstitutional. That was in Germany. But the same principle, if not in law, just in logic, applies to elections everywhere. Transparency is really the number one thing. And I think it's certainly conceivable that political operatives have hacked some prior elections. There are very many red flags. I don't say that there's proof, but one of the red flags is that no one ever seems to really allow meaningful manual recounts. And the other thing with these touchscreens is to have disproportionate distribution of touchscreen voting machines. In Ohio in 2004, typically it was in the high proportion minority districts, there were lines from 5 to 10 hours long, which absolutely can make a huge difference. I actually am pretty certain there's going to be some disproportionate distribution. There are arguments over that already in Georgia. In Georgia, there is a lawsuit that was filed by a small nonprofit called the Coalition for Good Governance, and it's founded by a woman named Marilyn Marks, who's a really fantastic election security advocate. And they have done a few things. The first step was to get a court ruling that Georgia's current paperless touchscreen voting machines are unconstitutional because they deprive voters of the right to have their votes counted as cast. And they actually got the federal court to rule to find them unconstitutional, which was huge. The second step is to get a similar ruling for these new touchscreen universal use barcode ballot marking devices. It appears that it is not going to happen in time for the primaries, but I think there is, knock on wood, I don't want to jinx anything, a reasonable chance that they may prevail in time for the general election.
Jennifer Cohn is concerned about electronic ballot marking devices, or BMDs, because there have been problems with them in previous elections. She wants them banned from use.
They are essentially really complicated, hackable, malfunctionable electronic pens. And then if you're going to want to have a machine count the ballots, you still need the scanners. And I've really been tracking the purchases of these systems throughout the country, and it's very alarming. It's often the most populous counties in many states that have purchased these between 2016 and now, and there are some swing states that have done this. We've had over a decade and a half of vote flipping that's always attributed to calibration errors, and these new ballot marking devices are going to have the same problems. And this is despite the fact in Pennsylvania, an ESNS representative gave this presentation, and it's on YouTube, where he's assuring everybody, scout's honor, that you don't have to worry about calibration with these new machines, and everybody sort of cheers, yay, we don't have to worry about calibration. Well, guess what? In Northampton County, Pennsylvania, they had massive issues with calibration and vote flipping. So this is just another problem.
Jennifer mentioned ESNS, a company that provides almost half of the voting technology in the U.S. She contends that it raises serious red flags when private for-profit companies, using proprietary rights to keep their technology secret,
monopolize our elections. And an investigation by The Guardian found that voting machine companies have been actively seeking to avoid scrutiny.
Right now, two vendors, ESNS of Omaha, Nebraska, and Dominion Voting, which at least started out as a Canadian company, account for more than 80% of U.S. election equipment. There's a third vendor called Hart InterCivic that accounts for about another 11%. So combined, the three vendors account for about 93% of U.S. election equipment, and all three are owned by private equity, which means we really don't know very much about who specifically owns the companies. They're LLCs. ESNS, which accounts currently for about 44% of U.S. election equipment, was founded in the 1970s by two brothers named Bob and Todd Yurosevich. And they founded the company with money from the families of two religious right activist billionaires. One was named Howard Amundson Jr., and the other was named Nelson Bunker Hunt. Both of these billionaires were major donors to the Chalcedon Foundation, which is Christian Reconstruction's main think tank. Both of these individuals, Hunt and Amundson, were high-profile and early members of a very powerful and secretive right-wing group called the Council for National Policy. And its recent members, as of 2014, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which obtained a copy of its 2014 directory, include the whole Cambridge Analytica cabal, which includes Kellyanne Conway, who was a consultant for Cambridge Analytica, Steve Bannon, who was the vice president of Cambridge Analytica, and Bob and Rebecca Mercer, who were the founders of Cambridge Analytica. Cambridge Analytica is the organization that worked with the 2016 Trump campaign on big data assimilation, and they used stolen Facebook data from many, many Facebook users to do targeted advertising. Other members of the Council for National Policy include Richard DeVos, Jay Sekulow, who is Trump's personal attorney, and it also includes Wayne LaPierre of the NRA. This 2014 directory also states that the Council for National Policy's goal is by 2020 to have, as they put it, reestablished or reaffirmed both religious and economic liberty under the U.S. Constitution. Many of the members in the group are very devout or hard right, religious right activists, and it's really a networking group for the religious right and billionaires.
After it was sued by the U.S. government in 2019, Cambridge Analytica declared bankruptcy. It was then acquired by a holding company with direct ties to its previous founder, right-wing billionaire Robert Mercer. Mercer and others in the Council for National Policy preach an ideology called dominionism, which seeks to impose a Christian government in the U.S. based on a fundamentalist interpretation of biblical law. Jennifer monitors the progress of legislation designed to rein in private equity voting technology companies and supports passage of the SAFE Act, which will ban BMDs or ballot marking devices. She also advocates for the use of hand-marked paper ballots and mandatory audits.
There have been several bills in the U.S. Congress to make our elections more secure. So the first, it's called the PAVE Act. Most of the universal use ballot marking devices would be banned under it, the ones with barcodes, which is most of the current generation. But it would also ban internet connectivity and remote access. There's another bill called the SAFE Act, which incorporated most but not all of the provisions of the PAVE Act, and it passed the House and went back to the Senate. But Mitch McConnell pretty much said that they were all dead on arrival and hasn't even allowed a Senate vote on any of them. Mitch McConnell is not, to my knowledge, directly connected with Kellyanne Conway and the other members of the CMP, but he did receive donations from both of these mega vendors, ESNS and Dominion Voting, before putting the kibosh on any sort of meaningful election security legislation. There are always things we can do short of even federal legislation. And what that requires is advocacy at sort of the grassroots. You can start with just an inquiry, just sending an email or making a phone call and asking are we going to be using electronic poll books on election day? And if so, are you going to have backup paper voter lists? And then if the answer is no, I'm on Twitter at JennyCohn1, and I now have this very large following of over 100,000 people, and quite a few in the media do follow me now, and I will amplify it for you.
Andrea Miller is the co-executive director in charge of information technology with People Demanding Action based in Virginia. She also spearheads the Center for Common Ground's Reclaim Our Vote campaign. In 2015, nearly half of the seats in the Virginia state legislature did not even have a Democratic Party contender. Miller and other grassroots organizers helped change that, making Virginia's legislature more representative of the state's diverse population. Andrea agrees with Jennifer Cohn about the dangers of voting machine technology, starting with electronic poll books.
Electronic poll books. Wow. Those are amazing things, because my mother had a really great saying, anything made by man breaks. It's not a question of if, it's a matter of when. So polling books, when they break, they're going to break on election day. And so you can't be sitting there going, well, I have no idea who the voters are, so, you know, nobody gets to vote. How's that? Or we also have seen the threat and the issue with hacking. You have an electronic poll book. It is living out there in the ether. Someone could go in, they could change addresses, shift one column down, and everybody on that poll book is screwed, because now nobody is giving you the right address. So now what do you do? Our technology, while it's designed to help us, we haven't thought it through properly, and we are just opening ourselves up for a major, major fall. Can anybody say 2020 Iowa caucus? Virginia had voting machines up until 2013. So when I voted in the 2013 primary, I was voting on a touchscreen machine. And when I touched the screen for the person I wanted to vote for and went next, and it was showing me what I'd marked, that was not what I marked. So I went back, did it again. It took me 3 tries on that touchscreen machine before I was able to get the candidates that I wanted. Now, that also happened to the man who was governor. The governor tried to vote, and the machine, it wasn't properly calibrated. It would not accept the people he had selected. So that's why Virginia went suddenly. We literally turned on a dime. 2014 in the general, machines were gone, and 90% of Virginia counties were voting on paper. So let's look at Virginia. In 2017, we got a lot of candidates to run. Grassroots activist type people decided they were going to run for office. All of them, it was their first run. Many of them had $10,000, maybe $20,000 for a well-funded one, going up against a 5, 10, 15-year incumbent who had millions of dollars in the bank. And with grassroots support, we came within one vote of one seat of tying for control of a house. And then 2019, Democrats took control of her Senate and her House. That is what changed Virginia. Virginia ratified the Equal Rights Amendment, the Virginia Green New Deal, which is a very aggressive, progressive Green New Deal, passed out of the Labor and Commerce Committee. Virginia is working on repealing right to work. Virginia is a completely different place. And I always say thank you to everybody who helped us, because Virginia can now say she is the former capital of the Confederacy. We did two main things, and there's really only two things you can do for elections. Number one, we looked at who were the people who have been, I call it, deregistered, and we work with what we call underrepresented voters, African American, Hispanic, Native American, Asians. And so I started looking at how many voters of color were in Virginia, who voted, who didn't vote, and I realized what we really needed to do was add community of color voters. So we were giving people valuable information. We were letting them know, you better check your voter registration status, and if it's not active, you're going to have to get re-registered.
Election purging.
Voter purge.
Purges people from its voter roll.
125,000 voters.
Representative Raul Grijalva released a statement. It reads in part, where there are lines lasting hours on end, ballot shortages, identification issues, erroneous party affiliations, or sparse polling locations, we must document these problems and implement policies that ensure they never happen again.
Since the Supreme Court's gutting of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, it's been open season on voting rights nationwide. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, voter suppression happens in many ways. That's why Andrea Miller founded the Center for Common Ground to empower underrepresented voters. Her advocacy focuses on the American South, a region well known for voter disenfranchisement against communities of color, and more recently, against younger voters. Her Reclaim Our Vote campaign is changing southern states like North Carolina, where a recent court ruling said that the state's suppression of African American voters was done with, quote, almost surgical precision.
The Voting Rights Act did put standards into place. And the other thing that it did was it looked very hard at states that had tried to prevent people from voting based on race or religion or various things. And they had come up with a term that they called preclearance. In order to change your state election laws, you had to get permission from the Department of Justice to make these changes. And that had kept everything much more even-handed. And so what happened was, under President Obama, there was this voice and this rolling call that America is now post-racial. We don't need preclearance anymore, which basically neutered it. And the moment that happened, then we started seeing states doing these wild and crazy things. We see Chris Kobach of Kansas saying, oh, there are these rampant issues of voter fraud. People are voting in multiple states. It's like, wait a minute, how is that possible? You know, are we talking about people jumping on their own private jet and flying from state to state to vote? And 7.8 million people lost their ability to vote. Notice I didn't say right, I said their ability. If we had a right, it wouldn't be so easy to take it from us, which is why they stopped too soon in the civil rights movement. They needed to take voting as a right all the way to the Constitution. If they had done that, that would have struck down felony disenfranchisement laws. So they stopped too soon. So that's one of the other things that I do work on, constitutional right to vote. One of the other incredible forms of voter suppression, and it was in the movie Suppressed, would be closing a polling location. So they wanted to close that polling location in Georgia, saying, oh, it costs $4,000, and that's just, we can't spend $4,000 to allow all these black people to vote. You know, who can afford that? And then it turns out they're spending $18,000 a year on Christmas decorations. You know, it's like, guys, really, come on, please. So you just have, every state has different rules. Every state has come up with a new twist or a new gotcha for the unsuspecting voters. My favorite was in 2015 when Alabama went to strict photo ID, they closed every DMV in the Alabama Black Belt. Just closed them. Said, gee gosh golly, we don't have money to run the DMV. Apparently, in no county in the Black Belt did they have enough money to keep a DMV office open.
For the upcoming election, Andrea hopes to mobilize the largest turnout ever, and key to that turnout is the 18 to 24-year-old voter. Andrea Miller has turned her attention to the youth vote.
There are so many different ways that that 18 to 24-year-old vote is suppressed. For instance, in Texas, you can vote and use a handgun license as your ID, but you can't use your college ID as a photo ID. You have to either get a Texas driver's license or buy a Texas ID. In many states, the voting precinct is a long way from campus. So in Alabama, we are working on the notion of let's get voting precincts on campus.
Andrea Miller is also convinced that in order to win in 2020, Democrats must concentrate on taking back the South. Her work promotes this strategy.
Civics lesson on America. America, we do not elect a president by popular vote. So when I ask the question, how many votes do you need to win the White House? There is only one correct answer, 270. We need 270 electoral votes. Boom, that's it. That's the way it works. Doesn't matter that we wish it worked some other way. It doesn't. So that means we're 39 votes short. Texas has got 38 of the 39 votes that we need. One state, Texas, is coming in right behind California. And then Georgia. Georgia's got two Senate races and 16 electoral votes. North Carolina's got 15. Alabama's got 9. Arizona's got 11. Florida's got 29. These are the numbers that I live with every day of my life.
Andrea supports eliminating electronic voting machines and returning to verifiable paper ballots, restoring voting rights to formerly incarcerated people, and making Election Day a federal holiday. And that's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact, produced by Women Rising Radio. Listen to our programs at womenrisingradio.com and at radioproject.org. Special thanks to Lisa Farino and National Voter Corps, and to Lisa Rudman and Making Contact. Women Rising Radio's producer is Lynn Feinerman, audio engineers Emily Harris and Stephanie Welch, and I'm your host, Sandina Robbins. Thanks for listening.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that has probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun. Living in the city where I'm working like a walrus, but man, I don't need your money, man, I'm gonna be an artist. And I'm feeling like I wanna do whatever I feel inside. I put it all on paper and I'll hope that people buy it. And my only minor worry is how to pay the rent, but that won't even matter when I lose my apartment. And I'll really have no worries, I'll be just like a cassette that you've taped up the tabs of to put something new on it. And when I hit record, God only knows what I will be. And if there is no God, then it's a better mystery. Fighting for survival, and I guess I must be winning. And my story is so long I can't remember the beginning. Am I an optimist or am I a pessimist? If I see that half full, half empty cup is half full of nothingness.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Crossing Boundaries, virtual fishing derby and auction from Saturday, September 20th.